This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amber Nickel, the host of the channel, and today we are going to be talking with Jeanne Dubreuil about her most recent publication, Exhibitions, Essays on Art and Atrocity, which came out recently on University of New Mexico Press. Jeanne Dubreuil is a professor in the Department of English at the University of North Texas. She has authored 9 books of poems and 3 books of creative nonfiction, including the text we will be discussing today, which is a collection of essays and micro-essays. Her work has appeared in numerous journals, and she is the founding editor of the national literary journal, Cherry Tree. Jeanne, welcome to the channel today. I am looking forward to discussing this text with you. Exhibitions does so many things, as it is part history, part art analysis, and part autobiography. I want to take a moment to focus on the latter part. Would you mind sharing a little bit about your unique background and how it informed your writing of this text?
That's a great question, Amber. So I'm the daughter of 2 U.S. Foreign Service officers. I grew up all over the world. I was born in Italy, and then we lived in Yugoslavia, Zaire, Poland, Belgium, Austria, and often between tours, we would come back to the United States. So all of my writing is informed by that nomadic childhood. And when we lived overseas, my parents collected art in the places where we lived. And that's how exhibitions began, was that I was thinking about these art objects that surrounded me when I was a little girl. And I began to think about what did it mean to be surrounded by this kind of beauty, especially given the fact that we often lived in places that were haunted by conflict, war, and genocide. And so that's how I started writing the essays in the book.
That is quite the background, and I think it really comes to life on the pages of your text. So let's talk a little bit about the organization of the book, which is, I think, also rather unique. As opposed to the traditional kind of parts and chapters approach, the text is organized into galleries and, I guess, what one might call pieces. What motivated you to take this approach to the organization of the text? And how did you decide which pieces went into which galleries?
So in my experience, putting together a book of creative writing, especially one that's comprised of disparate parts, often the organization is the last thing that falls into place. So I knew that I wanted the structure of the book in some ways to reflect the content. And so I began to think about how these art objects in the form of essays might be structured, and I started to think about the way one walks through a museum, traveling through different galleries. And maybe this is my thinking as a poet, but you know, in poetry, the word stanza, and the stanzas almost like the paragraph in a poem. The word stanza comes from the Italian and it means room. So I was already accustomed, I think, to thinking about language as an embodied space. And so that's how the galleries came to be, is that, you know, I thought, oh, you know, these essays are covering a wide range of life experiences. In some ways, I was writing a sort of Bildungsroman. And so I knew that the earliest essays in the book would be rooted in early childhood. And so that part was easy, but then realizing, no, these are spaces in a museum that the reader is walking through, allowed me then to start figuring out how to put things where. And so the beginning of the book focuses on these early childhood essays, and then the middle of the book is sort of more expansive. It's thinking about marriage and family inheritance. And then the latter part of the book is very much rooted in adulthood. And both the beginning and the ending of the book are also very much focused on genocide, in particular the Shoah. So that also was sort of another thread woven through the collection.
Almost all of your micro-essays and essays in this collection use, as you mentioned, a piece of art or art as a window into your own experiences with memory and with atrocity. We cannot talk about all of the pieces today, and I actually wish we could because I enjoyed reading every one. However, I would like to discuss a few. One of the essays that stood out to me as a reader, and perhaps this is just my bias as a reader, was The Dead Class, as it is excellently woven art, autobiography, and the complex history of Polish Jewry, both past and to an extent present. Would you mind telling listeners a little bit more about this particular essay?
Sure. So like many of the essays in the book, the jumping off point for my thinking was a specific piece of art. My parents have a small self-portrait. It's a kind of drawing with some painting elements and collage in it by Tadeusz Kantor. And Kantor was a renowned playwright, director, and visual artist, sort of associated with the avant-garde movement in the post-war period in Poland. And Kantor is most famous for a play called The Dead Class, which after it was first performed was then shot as a film by the extraordinary Polish filmmaker Andrzej Wajda. And so initially I was just trying to write about and think about this little piece by Kantor, but talking about this little self-portrait, which is a portrait of Kantor that he made a year before he died, and it's a death mask. So it's a portrait of himself already dead. And that fascinated me, his anticipation of his own death. And so I started writing about the image, but then that led me to write about The Dead Class, which is a really interesting balanced meditation on the long history of Polish Catholics and Polish Jews, and the way those histories are interwoven. And eventually the essay also becomes a meditation on my own experiences as an American Jew growing up in Poland, a landscape which, when we were there in the 1980s and early 1990s, of course, was largely Judenrein, free of Jews.
Another one of my favorite pieces was one titled Ambivalent Things. And it was both in terms of the content, but also the structure of the essay. For our listeners, would you mind sharing what is so unique about this particular piece in terms of both content and also structure?
Yeah, so Ambivalent Things is an essay about the pieces of Judaica that I own, which I think are beautiful objects, but which I never use. And Ambivalent Things is structured in a way that I would say is kind of Talmudic. So the main body of the text is divided into these little sections. Each section reflects on a different object, like Shabbat candlesticks or a mezuzah case or a challah cover. And each one of those sections is sort of unique in its voice. One section is told as almost like a little I.B. Singer short story. Another is written as a poem. There are other sections that are sort of more scholarly and contain research. And then on the right-hand side of the page, there's essentially Midrash. And the commentary is written in third person, analyzing the persona who's talking in the primary text. In other words, it's analyzing my voice, and, you know, deconstructing what each passage is saying and the kinds of claims it's making. And, you know, the central question of Ambivalent Things is, why own these pieces that represent ritual and belief if you're a secular Jew who struggles with both ritual and belief? And ultimately, I think, as is the case with a lot of essays and exhibitions, the essay isn't sure what to do with that question in the end, and simply accepts that it will live in a state of ambivalence about these issues. And maybe, again, that comes from my training as a poet. Poets are taught to be comfortable with and perhaps even to welcome ambivalence. And so I think that perspective often seeps into my essays as well. Also, the word essay, of course, comes from the French essayé, which means to attempt. And so my training as an essayist is to attempt a search for answers, not necessarily to arrive at answers, but to reside in a place of uncertainty.
Wow. I am so glad that I read that correctly. I wanted to make sure. It's always kind of interesting as a reader when you're assuming something is going on, but you're not sure if that was the attempt that was made. I think as opposed to me kind of walking readers through or listeners through your different pieces, essays and micro essays today, I might ask that you read maybe a portion or some portions of some of them, since they are very eloquently written.
Sure. So I think I'll read a little bit from the essay that you asked me about, The Dead Class, you know, this essay about the work of Tadeusz Kantor and my childhood in Warsaw. So I'm just going to read two little passages from the middle of this essay. I am 11 or 12 when I begin to realize that we are Jews. There is almost no religion in our household, so the gradual recognition of our Jewishness has nothing to do with prayers read from a certain book, or rules about consuming meat and milk, or a parchment scroll affixed to a doorway. Instead, I realize that the party we attend one winter, where all the children receive presents and we eat potato pancakes with applesauce, is to celebrate not Christmas, but Hanukkah. There is an earlier memory of a long dinner that included a story of leading one land for another, a platter holding a bone, some bitter herbs. We dip our fingers into glasses of wine, tapping red drops on the edges of our plates. At the American School of Warsaw, my classmates who come from all over the world are starting to tell me that I'm a Jew. Kike, they say, or Jid. Sometimes they indicate the problem is my hair, not only the dark curls that fall across my face, but also the fuzz on my arms and legs. In eighth grade, the other students leave in my locker a note signed by everyone in the class. Monster, it says, you're disgusting. It's a notice of expulsion. The loneliness of the dead, how they are isolated by what they know about themselves and about us. This is what I see when I look at Kantor in his self-portrait. Although the eyes appear almost shut in the drawing, the face is pointed with intensity. The artist seems to have visualized himself dying in a moment of concentration, thought. Sitting in my parents' living room after a cocktail party, I consider the knowledge held in that still face. The closer I lean into the drawing, the more I see it's not merely a composition of black ink on off-white paper. There are smudges of brown on his forehead and shoulders, the corpse already touched by dirt. And around the jaw, some dark lines have been erased with white paint, so the body is both a place of presence and disappearance. Mrs. P., my history teacher, has decided that the 8th grade class field trip to Kraków will not include the customary excursion to Auschwitz this year, although it's only an hour's drive away from the city. She's an anti-Semite, my favorite teacher, Mrs. H. tells me, as we eat lunch together in her classroom. As far as I know, Mrs. H. and I are the only Jews in school. I often sit with her during recess and free periods, reading while she grades papers, or else we talk about books. Mrs. H. is everyone's favorite teacher. Given how bullied I am, how much my classmates enjoy whispering, "You're hideous and you stink," Mrs. H.'s popularity is miraculous to me. That she can make her strangeness so appealing to others is like the wonder of a tiny cup of oil lasting 8 days when there is only enough to burn for one night. Small and rounded, with wine-red lips and a thick bob of dark hair, she is always draped in a woven shawl, gesturing at the blackboard, her movements theatrical, her voice carrying to the back row of desks. In my memory, she never speaks sternly. She laughs. Although a woman in her mid-40s, she announces, "I'm 29, darling," no matter how many times the boys ask, "But how old are you really?" Mrs. H. seems to me a figure of joyful comedy and good humor. One time she gives me a taste of dried yak curd. It's a present from another student, and when I bite into the small yellowed lump of cheese, it turns to sour chalk in my throat. Hacking and spitting the mouthful into a trash can, I turn to Mrs. H. "How delicious," I say, laughing and laughing. On the field trip to Kraków, I cry when Mrs. P. makes me share a room with my greatest tormentor, a large Australian girl, easily a foot taller than I am, who loves to bump against me in the hallways, and who mocks my name, "John. Isn't that a boy's name? Aren't you really a boy?" Years later, I live for 2 months in the small town of Oschenschim, or Auschwitz, as it's called in German. On weekends, I take a rattling bus to Kraków, where I'm amazed to learn Mrs. H. now lives. Although she's going to be away for most of my visit, she gives me a key so that I can stay in her apartment, only a short walk from the beautiful square at the center of the city. Afternoons, I sit outside at a cafe. The woven backs of the chairs, harp-shaped, are just as Robert Pinsky describes them in The Unseen. But unlike the characters in Pinsky's Holocaust poem, I am not making up my mind to tour the death camp. I have already been touring them almost compulsively. These Saturdays and Sundays in Kraków are my break from walking the grounds of Auschwitz I and II, where watch the tourists touch the concrete dividers of the barbed wire fences no longer electrified, this place of preserved horror, with its rooms full of shoes and shorn hair, what Pinsky calls the whole unswallowable menu of immensities. In Kraków, I eat a piece of the apple cake known as Charlotka, licking caramelized juices and powdered sugar from my fingers. Every hour on the hour, there's a sound from the church spire nearby. A trumpeter plays a 5-note melody, the Haynau. Always the music ends halfway through, the tune suddenly stopping. The famous explanation for this ritual is a Mongol invasion in the 13th century. Spotting the intruders at the gate, a sentry tried to trumpet a warning to the city. But before he could finish the song, an arrow punctured his throat.
Okay. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Wow. Thank you. I now wish that you would record the entire thing so I could listen to it. Because it's so much more beautiful coming from your own voice or coming in your own voice.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
We have taken up quite a bit of your time today. I want to wrap up our interview with my traditional closing question on New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Thank you for that question. So I am working on a craft book. It's called The Wounded Line, A Guide to Writing Poems of Trauma. And it's a book intended for poets at any stage of their development, but it comes out of my 20 years of writing, thinking, and teaching about how we write about atrocity, especially genocide, especially the Shoah. And so the book is very much built on my training in Holocaust studies, thinking about issues of representation. And essentially in the book, I offer a series of best practices for writing about trauma in general. And then the book contains 20 chapters, each one focusing on a specific technique that poets can use to write about trauma, whether that's a small-scale personal trauma, something intimate within their own family, or a large-scale, historically rooted trauma, such as genocide or war or exile or some other form of persecution. And I hope this book is going to be really useful, not only in the classroom, but also to poets trying to figure out these challenges on their own. The Wounded Line is going to be the first book in a new series of craft books that I will be editing, published through the University of New Mexico Press, called Writing About Trauma. And so future books, we hope, will explore these same questions. For instance, how do you do this in the graphic novel? Or how do you do this in a memoir? Or how do you do this in a young adult's novel? Or how do you do this in short fiction? Or how do you do this in film? You get the idea. So that eventually it'll be a whole series of books that offer useful strategies to artists across genres trying to figure out the challenge of representing trauma in their own art forms.
That sounds amazing. And it looks like you have now filled up my reading list with an entire series of things to read. John, thank you for joining us on New Books in Jewish Studies today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to have a chance to talk about my work.
And listeners, if today's discussion caught your interest, and I know it did, please pick up a copy of Exhibitions, Essays on Art and Atrocity, directly from the University of New Mexico Press, or order it from your local bookstore.